This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh, and today I'm talking to one of my favorite philosophers, Professor Shelley Kagan. Professor Shelley Kagan is a Clark Professor of Philosophy at Yale. He's the author of Limits of Morality, Normative Ethics, and the Geometry of Desert. I think Professor Shelley Kagan is very well known to many people through his YouTube lectures at Yale on death. He's a cool-looking professor wearing shoes, you know, just sitting on the desk. Today, he's here to talk with us about a book he published with Oxford University Press called How to Count Animals, More or Less, which was published in 2019. Shelley, thank you very much for accepting this invitation.
Thank you for having me.
There have been a lot of books on animal ethics, and that it's our moral duty to protect animals, and the animals are equally important as human beings. You take a completely different field, your attitude towards this topic in your book, How to Count Animals. Before talking about that book, I would appreciate it if you could briefly tell us about your field of expertise, and also tell us why you became interested in the area of animal ethics. And you decided to write a book in this area.
So I'm a moral philosopher. I teach at Yale University. I don't normally work on topics that are in the field we call a topic like working like animal ethics as you do applied ethics. Most of what my work is highly abstract. You mentioned, for example, the book The Geometry of Desert, and this raises certain questions about people being more deserving, less deserving, if they can't get exactly what they deserve, is it better to give them too much, a little too little? It's all completely abstract, full of diagrams and the like. So I don't normally work in something as concrete as thinking about animal ethics. The story of how I came to write the book is, in some sense, fairly straightforward. I was invited to give a series of lectures at Oxford, at the Uehiro Center, which is the Uehiro Center for Practical Ethics. And as the name suggests, what they're looking for is not the kind of highly abstract work that I'm normally doing, but work on more concrete moral questions. I initially resisted doing that, but one of my colleagues at Oxford, friend pointed out that I had recently taught a seminar on animal ethics. So I occasionally teach more applied topics. And he said, well, I can do something on that. So I worked up over the next year or two, I worked up more systematically what my views, which I'd only worked up in a very tentative overview fashion in the seminar itself. One of the terms of the contract to give the Uehiro lectures was, in conjunction with Oxford, was I had to commit myself to turning the lectures into a book. And I did that in what for me was remarkable turnaround time. The same book I mentioned a few moments ago, The Geometry of Dessert, I worked on for 20 years. That's right, 20 years. And in contrast, from the time I started working on the lectures to the time the book came out, can't have been more than 3 or 4 years. So from that point of view, this was a rush job for me. But it was quite a pleasure to take on something new that I hadn't been thinking about for decades, work up a set of views. As you also remarked, I don't know whether you might be getting into this point yet, but the position that I ended up taking was rather different from most of the views that are taken in the animal ethics literature, and for that matter, different from the views I had held previously. That is, it was a rethinking of my own view over the course of a couple of years.
And I think that's a great point. Great point to start talking about the standard position of those who support animals. And we must say it's not when we are saying that. Maybe I'm not putting in the right word. It's not that we are against animal rights. It's just a different philosophical take to it. So there has been this growing interest in animal ethics in the past 50 years. So maybe you can start talking about that, why it has become so popular, and also the position that you call Unitarianism, which is the standard position of animal ethics. Can you talk about that and explain the idea of moral status? Because you bring in that idea of moral status there as well.
Good, great. So let me give a quick overview of the history of the discussion of animals within Western moral philosophy. For most of the time, there's been Western moral philosophy for thousands of years. During most of that time, there's been virtually no discussion about what, if anything, we owe to animals. There'll probably be some remark to the effect of one shouldn't go around gratuitously hurting animals, causing them pain for no good reason, and that might be about as far as the discussion went. Kant, Immanuel Kant, the great German thinker, thought that in terms of the divine, there are people on the one hand and there are things on the other. And just like there'd be no moral objection, I don't have a prop where I could grab a piece of paper and rip it in half. There'd be no moral objection to ripping a piece of paper. It doesn't count in its own right. We don't owe anything to the piece of paper. Kant thought that we don't owe anything to animals either. And he felt slightly queasy. He didn't want to think it was okay to rip up an animal for no good reason. And so he was forced to defend proper treatment of animals by saying something like, well, anybody who goes around being mean to animals is going to end up being mean to people. And since it's wrong to be mean to people, that's why you shouldn't be mean to animals. It wasn't a very compelling argument. What we feel intuitively is that animals count, but most of us, when we reflect on it, animals count at least somewhat in their own right. Even people who eat meat think that to just gratuitously harm a cow or a cat. I mean, here's kind of an example that gets thrown around in the literature. Imagine I bring out a cat, not a piece of paper, but a cat, and I douse it with gasoline and then set it on fire. Virtually everybody would say that's wrong. So animals have to count in their own, and it's not just wrong because that means I'm going to the next day start dousing people with gasoline. Oh, Kant, that's crazy. It's that I've somehow wronged the cat itself by hurting it. So this is not that this view's never been expressed. Another famous moment in the history of Western philosophy with regard to animals is Jeremy Bentham. He's the father of what gets called utilitarianism. He was John Stuart Mill's teacher. Bentham said, in defending the claim that animals count, the relevant question is not whether you're rational, whether you can speak. The relevant question is whether you can suffer, whether you can feel pain. And so Bentham and the utilitarians that came after him thought that animals counted, but didn't do a whole lot with this. And so the topic wasn't much discussed. The question, you know, the concept that you asked about a moment ago about status is just this idea of what sorts of things count and why. And intuitively, we would probably all agree pieces of paper don't count. In here's a pen. This pen doesn't count. I see background next to you, and you've got a plant in your room. Most of us think plants don't count morally in and of themselves. We don't owe anything to plants. Of course, it would be wrong for me to tear that plant. Yeah, if we were in the same room, it would be wrong for me to tear that plant apart. But that's because it's your plant, and I'd be wrong in you. The plant doesn't count in its own right. And we can capture this thought. You may not believe that, but we can capture this thought in the vocabulary of moral status or moral standing. Which sorts of things do we owe some kinds of moral obligations to directly by virtue of the nature of the entity? So what most of us think is that plants don't count, but in contrast, most of us think cats do count. And that's about as far as the topic generally had gone. In the 60s, there was a group of philosophers at Oxford who started thinking this is not taking sufficiently seriously. Our behavior towards animals doesn't take our obligations to animals sufficiently seriously. And Peter Singer was part of this group. He didn't create the movement, but in some sense, he kick-started it or jump-started it. He published a book in 1975 called Animal Liberation. And what he said in the book was, if you take seriously the thought that it would be wrong to set a cat on fire, this is not his example, but it'd be wrong to set a cat on fire because after all, the cat can feel pain. And so it counts. Then you have to conclude, if you're open-minded and fair-minded about this, that it's wrong to eat meat the way the cows, for example, are raised in contemporary factory farming. Causes them a tremendous amount of pain. Cows, chickens, pigs, veal. They're basically tortured for their lives, and then they're killed. And then Singer says, if you think about the moral significance of their suffering and weigh that against minimal moral weight of the pleasure you might get out of eating cow flesh, it can't be justified. And the fact that we don't see it, and here becomes a crucial term of art, the fact that we don't see that is the fact that it is a reflection of the fact that we are speciesists. This term was deliberately meant to be remind us of being a racist. A racist is somebody who treats different races differentially simply by virtue of what their race is, or a sexist. A sexist is somebody who treats men as counting being more valuable than women. A speciesist is somebody who says, people, humans, count more than cows, count more than chickens. And so Singer was saying, no, this, in the relevant sense, all animals are equal. And to put the point in a kind of, in terms of philosophical jargon, moral standing, animals have moral standing in terms of their status. The thought was their status is the same as our status. Counting morally is something that's binary, it's on off. You count or you don't count. But if you do count, and we take your counting seriously, we have to count animal suffering as much as human suffering. Animal interests have the same weight as human interests and the like. To put it in terms of a slogan that Singer offered, and it's a really evocative slogan, pain is pain. So this was the idea that Singer popularized. And when I read it, the book in the mid-70s, I think it came out in 75. When I read it in the mid-70s, I was convinced. I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. One needs to become a vegetarian. And animals count the same way that we do. Many decades later, when I am teaching this seminar, when did I teach the seminar? 2012, 2013, something like that. I started working through the issues again after Singer wrote. A bunch of other people started working on the field. Some people said, yes, animals count, but we shouldn't think about them in utilitarian terms. Most people, when they think about our ethical obligations to other people, don't think about in terms of utilitarianism. That's philosophers' jargon for the view that right and wrong is just a matter about bringing about the best results. And in contrast, most people are deontologists and think that certain actions can be wrong, even if the results would be better. Killing an innocent person would be objectionable, even if this did more good in the long run. So views like that are called deontological views. So some people started saying, yes, Singer, you're right. Animals count. We need to think about this seriously. But we need to think about this in deontological terms. Interestingly enough, even these people, though, ended up saying animals count in exactly the same way that people do. People should be thought of in deontological terms, so animals should be thought of in deontological terms. Status is still this binary. But I found myself thinking when I started revisiting these issues, as I say, at this point, maybe 10 years ago, 9 years ago, that it seemed to me that although animals count, they don't count in the same way that people do. That, to put it in just another slogan, people count more than animals. And not all animals count equally. Some animals count more than other animals, morally speaking. And so we should give more weight to promoting the interests of people than we should to promoting the interests of cows. And more weight to promoting the interests of cows than we should to promoting the interests of snakes, let's say, or houseflies, which might still count somewhat. And so I began to develop, in contrast to this view I've just been sketching, which says, details aside of how we need to treat people and animals, there's only one kind of status. I dubbed that view Unitarianism, for this view that is still probably prevalent and dominant in the philosophical literature of the last 50 years, but hadn't been given a name. And I found myself thinking, animals count, but the correct moral theory won't be a Unitarian. It won't be one that just treats it as though all moral statuses are the same, but rather will distinguish between different levels of moral status, such that some things, it's more important to count certain interests more than, for certain types of creatures more than others. So that's where the whole project came from.
Mm-hmm. And that's the hierarchical view that you endorse in your book, in contrast to Unitarianism. So What is that hierarchical view? And so maybe you could put forth some arguments. Why do you think humans can't more animals? And what I found really amazing in your book was that you, it's not only black and white, you also talk about animals, that even in the realm of animals, there are some animals that, just as you mentioned now, that count more than others. So can you talk about this aspect of your book?
Sure. So, one question is, do we have reasons for thinking that a hierarchical approach is right? I mean, that some types of creatures count more than other types of creatures. And then secondly, if you do think that, then what are the features by virtue of which some animals are going to count more than others, and by virtue of which people are going to count more than most animals? So let me quickly sketch two arguments for thinking that the Unitarian view is at least one that taken to its logical implications, is probably going to strike most of us as troubling. So one view says this. Most of us, when we think about our moral values, include egalitarian sentiments. We think that it's a very, very bad thing that there are people who lead lives that are so much worse than the rest of us. And probably anybody listening to this podcast has a comfortable life. Obviously, there'll be variation here, but we know that large parts of humanity have lives that are not nearly as good as my life or your life. So we take it to be a really significant moral priority that we should be devoting our attention to trying to improve the lot of the worst. That's an egalitarian sentiment. Mm-hmm. That most of us think that that's an important value to put include in our moral theory. But if you then start thinking about the level of well-being, not that people have, you know, the poor versus the rich or the sick versus the healthy, but think about the quality of life of a chicken, let's say, or a mouse, it's very, very plausible to think that a mouse's life isn't nearly as good, isn't remotely as good as the life that you and I are having. This is why if some fairy godmother came down and said, you can have the life of the best possible mouse life for your life, even with its imperfections, you'd say, yeah, I'm not sorry. Human lives are much, much better than even the best possible mouse life.
Mm.
That being the case, if we then combine this with egalitarianism and then adopt the Unitarian view that says, well, animals count and there's only one moral status, and so we have to prioritize improving the plight of the worse off. Well, it's pretty clear that most animals are going to have significantly worse lives than most all humans. And then that means that when you combine Unitarianism with an egalitarian value in your moral theory, instead of trying to prioritize helping badly off people, we have to prioritize making the lives of mice better, making the lives of chickens as good as they possibly could be. Doing everything we can to improve the lot of fish. And again, it's not that I don't think we should reduce animal suffering. Far from it. But it strikes me as implausible to think that, if we were to discover that there are humans that were having lives as bad as the lives of mice or chickens, we would think this has to be our number one moral priority, fixing that. But when we think about the fact that chickens have the kinds of lives that chickens have, I think we don't want to conclude, so improving their lives should be our number one moral priority.
Mm.
Instead, we say, maybe the Unitarian went wrong in saying chickens count every bit as much as people do. Here's another quick argument. I mentioned that there are deontologists who think, as most people are deontologically minded, whether or not they know the term. And they think that certain actions would be wrong, even if the result would be really good. Suppose that by chopping up one innocent person, I could get organs and then a heart, a liver, a kidney, and then use those organs to be transplanted into, say, five other people. Almost everybody, not the utilitarians, but almost everybody would say that's not morally justified. Even though the results might be better to have five alive than just one, it's not morally okay to kill an innocent person in order to do more good. All right, so suppose you've got that deontological thought and then combine that with Unitarianism. If animals count and they count the very same way that you and I count, then we have to say it's also wrong to kill, let's say, a fish. Even if that's the only way to save several people's lives. Suppose we're hungry and we're marooned and it's going to be a while for us to have the ship come and save us. Not here talking about, whether we should become vegetarians, where there's no necessity for us to eat animal flesh. I'm asking you to imagine a case where eating a fish would save your life long enough for the ship to come. The Unitarian has to say, no, if you combine deontology with Unitarianism, that's not okay. And I want to say, no, so much the worse for Unitarianism. If we've got to accommodate the very robust intuitions that, of course, you shouldn't eat fish, you don't need to, but if that's the only way to stay alive, it's okay to eat a fish, I think we've got to give up the Unitarianism. So arguments like this. Obviously, I'm moving quickly beyond a lot of the details and possible responses that the Unitarian could give. But arguments like this are what led me to believe, led me to conclude, no, I guess I really don't think that there's only one moral status. I do think that, of course, it's wrong to kill animals, but the right to life of an animal, as I put it, is a weaker right to life than the right to life of a person. And the egalitarian claims of animals, although I do think they have them, we should try to reduce animal suffering. The egalitarian claims of animals are weaker than the egalitarian claims of people. And so that's how I began to develop, and that's how I argue for, a more hierarchical view. So that's the first of the two questions you just posed, right? That why be a hierarchical theorist at all? Yeah, and then the second question is, all right, then what is it that gives you a higher status than other things? And again, all I can do is just invite anybody listening to this podcast to think, okay, it does seem to me as though humans count more than animals. It's a minority view among philosophers, but it's something much more like the common sense view, I think, among reflective people, reflective individuals. What is it about being a person that makes us special? Not uniquely special in that we're the only thing with any kind of status at all, but counting more. Start asking yourself, go back to the question, the assertion I made a moment ago about that the life of a person is a better life to have than the life of a mouse. You know, ask, why is that? What is it that we have that mice don't have? Well, we mice can feel pleasure, and we can feel pleasure, but there are types of pleasures that humans have with a greater resonance and depth than anything that I take it that a mouse can have. I don't really know whether mice have any kind of aesthetic sense or not, but I assume that they're not capable of enjoying great visual beauty and anything like depth and emotional depth of response that we've got. Dogs know things about the world, but the human capacity for knowledge exceeds anything based on the available evidence that dogs are capable of. So we have greater emotional depth. We have greater cognitive depth and capacities. We can reflect on our situation and project ourselves into the future. Animals can project themselves into the future, but we can project ourselves into the future in a much more complicated way. And so there's a variety of dimensions that I think help explain what makes it true that we can have better lives than most animals can. And these same sorts of considerations, I think, point us in the direction of the sorts of things that we would want to take into account in thinking about what is it about us that makes us matter more than a chicken? Well, there's the things that I just mentioned. Now, there's other things as well. It's that we have a moral sense. We have a certain degree of creativity. We have the ability to govern our own behavior as a result of reflection in a way that, again, I don't want it at all, because that animals don't have these capacities in any degree, but it seems very plausible to hold that we have them to a much greater or higher quality degree. And so it's these sorts of things that I think point to the explanation as to why we count more. And then within the animal kingdom, one begins to distinguish as well about which animals have these kinds of capacities, cognitive and emotional, to a greater degree than others. And so I think this is what generates the varying degrees of moral status.
So what about this argument that if this argument is true, then can we also say that even among humans, there are humans who have a higher moral status or higher status than other human beings, just the same way that you make that case with that argument about animals?
Right. Yeah. I mean, when one thinks about, all right, so I laid out in a very quick way some arguments in favor of the hierarchy view. It's very important that we recognize that the hierarchy view seems open to, susceptible to various objections. And indeed, in the How to Con Animals book, I devote an entire chapter to being honest.
When I was reading the book, I was reading your arguments. Okay, I understand, but I disagree. And I was writing notes. Then I came across that chapter. You had predicted all the counter arguments, and you started addressing them.
That's great. I'm pleased to hear it. I mean, I wanted there to be a fair appraisal of the strengths and weaknesses of this position, and I'll get to the particular objection that you mentioned in a moment. But I think one important thing to realize here, this is actually very frequently true in philosophy, but it's certainly true here, is that no position is cost-free. Anything we might say about animal ethics is going to have spots where it strikes us that that's kind of hard to believe. That's a hard position to embrace without some misgivings. And so it's always a question of, with an open mind, trying to evaluate the rival positions and see which on balance does the best job. Every view is going to have certain implications that are a little bit hard to swallow or be comfortable with. I mean, think about the position that says animals don't count at all. If you really think animals don't count at all, then there was no objection, really, to setting the cat on fire in that fanciful example before. That's very hard to believe. Say, even Kant felt uncomfortable saying that. And so he desperately, looked around, tried to find some psychological claim that would allow him to say, well, you really shouldn't be killing cats. But the obvious thought is, no, it's not plausible to think animals don't count at all. All right. Well, so we say animals do count. Well, then one possibility is the Unitarian view. You say all animals count equally. But then you're stuck saying, all right, so if I'm, say, a deontologist and I believe that it's wrong to kill one innocent person, say 5 or 10 or even 100, other people, then you've got to say it's wrong to kill a fish to get to save 1, 5, or 10, or 100, people. That's very hard to believe as well. Now, again, in fairness, I have to say there are some moves that the Unitarian deontologist can make here that would really be getting into weeds, probably not appropriate for this conversation. But when all is said and done, I think Unitarianism really is stuck with some very unintuitive. All right. Well, if we don't want to say animals don't count at all, and we don't want to say animals count the same way that we do, then what's the alternative? Is to say animals count, but less than we do. And then you've got various ways of trying to work that out. Now, let me mention a hierarchical view that I'm not myself sympathetic to, but is worth at least considering. Maybe all people have the very same moral status. They have kind of deontological rights not to be killed, even if the results would be better. And all animals count, but they shouldn't be counted in a deontological fashion. They should be treated more like the utilitarians say that everybody should be treated. Maybe what we should do, we can kill an animal if that would do more good, but we shouldn't kill a person even if that would do more good. And so, maybe it's deontology for people, but utilitarianism for animals. That would be a hierarchical view. A view like this was discussed by Robert Nozick, a great philosopher who died some years ago. He didn't actually believe that view was adequate, but he thought it was worth considering. And I think that probably comes closer to the common sense view. But to defend that view, you have to say, what is it that people have that animals don't have, such that we should have a claim to having deontological rights and animals don't have that claim because they haven't got the thing that we know, whatever the thing is. And the obvious answer to that is the proposal that gets made is that people have autonomy and animals don't. And then you've got to start explaining about what is autonomy. It's something about having a vision about how you want your life to go and being able to make choices, in keeping with that vision and the like. And I think, yes, most people do have autonomy. And we certainly have it to a higher degree than animals do. But I don't think it's plausible to think that animals don't have any amount of autonomy. And so there's no real underlying philosophical justification for saying that people should have deontological rights and animals shouldn't have deontological rights of any sort at all. Rather, it seems to me the conclusion should be people should have deontological rights, but animals, by virtue of their autonomy, but to a smaller degree, should have weaker deontological rights. All right, so these are the sorts of considerations you have to go back and forth and weigh up the pros and the cons of various positions. But then you've got the objection that you mentioned, which I haven't yet addressed fully. I've been stalling for time. I've been saying, look, every view's got problems. So isn't it true that on the view that I've been sketching, no more than sketching, we have to say, look, if by virtue of having a greater aesthetic sense, you count more morally, if by virtue of having more creativity, you count more morally, if by virtue of having more moral control and moral motivation, you count more morally, if by virtue of having a greater degree of autonomy, you count more morally, then don't we have to say that people differ in this way as well? And so aren't we led to the conclusion that not only do people count more than animals, you know, people count more than dogs, but dogs count more than fish. Don't we have to say that some people count morally more than others? And that's an implication that I think many, many, many people will find just totally unacceptable. Now, again, that's why I gave the little preamble. Every viewer is going to have implications that are very, very hard to swallow. I mean, even the Unitarian position is going to say, look, if what makes you count is the ability to feel pleasure and pain, then don't we have to talk about certain severely cognitively impaired humans that don't have that kind of level of consciousness, and so then they won't have the kind of standing that we think matters. And so it would be okay to use them as organ factories. And that's, again, that most of us find a conclusion that's hard to believe. So it's very difficult philosophically to avoid all versions of this objection. Anyway, all right, having conceded that there is this unintuitive implication, what is that one can say in response? So there's a short answer and there's a somewhat longer answer. And I'm sympathetic to both. The short answer is, yes, there are differences in moral status among people, but we have to keep in mind, now that we've zoomed out to be taken into account the entire animal kingdom, and you think about the differences between people on the one hand and dogs, down to fish, down to flies, in terms of any kind of scale that's going to go all the way from insects up to people, the differences among ordinary people are going to be trivial. They're going to be negligible. For all practical purposes, we could never, ever accurately assess, do you have a better memory than I do? Do you have a more developed aesthetic sense than I do? I'm pretty creative philosophically, but you're pretty creative when it comes to narratives. Which of these is more important? So, we could never really do that in real time. And the differences would be so trivial that from a practical point of view, we should just neglect them. Some people may find it an adequate answer. And to be perfectly honest, I think that is probably something like the truth. But you can get a more complicated version of this answer when you emphasize this point about from the practical point of view, because there's a lot of differences that may matter that an adequate moral theory in some sense shouldn't pay attention to, because an adequate moral theory needs to be not super fine-grained. Think about the kinds of moral statuses that I'm saying, look, apes count more than dogs. Dogs are fairly, pigs are quite intelligent. Dogs are pretty intelligent. Mice are actually fairly intelligent. But fish, they actually have some souls, but less intelligent. Snakes, less intelligent, etc. But, even within, dogs, are going to be variations in level of intelligence. Among mice, there's going to be variations in level of intelligence. Among birds, there's going to be variations. Some birds are highly intelligent, other bird species less so. It would be impossible to have in a practical, workable way, a moral code which told me anytime I'm going to interact with an animal, I have to figure out its IQ. I have to figure out its emotional intelligence and all these other dimensions. We don't have the time. We don't have the ability to gain that kind of information in real, we can stipulate in a philosophical thought experiment, but in the real world, we can't do it. So the only practical morality is going to be more coarse-grained. Instead of having an infinite number of levels, with continuity, you can be a little bit more, count a little bit less. So psychologists have long since known that people can't really keep straight more than about 7 things. And so it strikes me as pretty plausible to think that from a practical point of view, we're going to have to divide the animal kingdom into some very big, coarse-grained levels. And so we're going to have the very intelligent animals, maybe primate, the upper primates, the great apes, maybe elephants, maybe whales, right? And then there's going to be the intelligent mammals, and then there's going to be the bird brain. I'm not prepared to actually argue exactly what the groupings are going to be, but the thought's going to be, we don't have the mental capacity to have there be more than 6 or 7 or maybe 10 groupings. And what that means is we can't spare 3, 5, 7 groupings to do these fine-grained distinctions among people. From a practical point of view, the only workable moral theory is going to be one that basically says, except for the extraordinary cases, like maybe the severely brain deformed, et cetera, severely cognitively impaired, anencephalics, don't have upper brain development. With those exceptions, basically, you got a person, treat them like a person, because we can't make fine-grained distinction within any kind of workable morality. That still leaves the philosophical question, is this just a kind of compromise? So that strictly speaking, some people do comp more, or no, these groupings really then become the truth about morality, that everything within these things, the fine-grained distinctions don't matter. This is, I think, another one of these in-house debates about how to understand certain rule-based approaches in moral philosophy. And again, I'll avoid getting into the weeds here. Some people will say these coarse-grained groupings are only a kind of compromise, but they don't really get to the fundamental moral facts. Others will say, no, this is really the way you should behave. But I think this goes some distance towards if not eliminating, at least reducing some of the bite of the quite important objection that you raise. What should we say about these minor differences that differentiate one person from another?
As you just mentioned, no idea is completely, let's say, sealed from criticism. And what I liked about your book is that you put forth your ideas. You do acknowledge that maybe some of the objection could be right. You do address again them as best as you can. And one thing I liked that I do like you to talk about as well is the idea of practical realism as well, because you use that framework to respond to that, to those objections for hierarchical approach.
Yes. So practical realism is the term I created for just this thought that I've just been articulating, that from a practical point of view, being realistic about what we can actually do in the practical domain, an overly fine-grained approach is just not feasible. You need a more coarse-grained approach. And the in-house debate is the practical realism a just kind of rough guide, or is it no, this actually distinguishes the morally relevant groupings. Let me give an analogy. It's one that I share in the book. Think about speed limits. What we know is that as you move faster and faster, as you're driving faster and faster, it's harder and harder to control. There's a greater and greater risk of accidents. Slower and slower speeds save lives. On the other hand, it takes us at low and lower speeds to it saves lives, but it takes us all longer to get home. So we pay a cost one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So we do our best from a practical point of view. We distinguish various kinds of groups. We have lower speed limits on residential streets. We have faster speed limits on commercial streets. We have faster speed limits still on highways, certain stretches of some of the states where there are many, many, many miles between cities. We have faster speed limits still. Now, you might say, this has got to just be an illusion, right? Because what's the difference between going 58 miles an hour and 59 miles an hour? That's a very small difference in terms of risk and danger of accidents, versus going 64 miles an hour and 66 miles an hour. It's, again, it's just a mile to a mile per hour. That's a trivial difference. So isn't it an illusion? But no, for practical reasons, we have to draw lines. And so having drawn the lines, it's a fact. It's not an illusion. It's a fact. You're going 66 miles an hour in a 65 miles an hour highway, you are breaking the law. You're going 64 miles an hour, you are not breaking the law. And so even though in some sense the underlying facts about danger and risk are continuous, out of practical necessity, we generate lines. And then those lines actually do matter legally. That's the difference between speeding and not speeding from a legal point of view. And so one way of taking these notions of practical reason with a practical realism within the moral domain seriously is to say, yeah, we're going to need these coarse grained categories, but just like there's a jet, it's not a fiction that driving 67 miles an hour is illegal, but 64 miles an hour is legal. That's the literal truth. One way of taking the practical realism idea seriously is to say, yeah, these categories, once we rough them out, they genuinely demarcate the relevant groupings until you find yourself in an extraordinary situation. And then that's worth pausing on as well. I mean, just like when you're driving, yes, the speed limit is 65 miles an hour, but the law recognizes exceptions, that there are necessity cases. You're rushing to get your injured husband to the hospital. You know, when the cop stops you, you say, my husband's bleeding in the back. Oh, okay, let's speed, right? That's legally permissible because you identified an exception case. We can quibble about what the exception cases are, right? Yeah. If in our first pass we end up putting birds in some second or third tier, and then when animal psychologists discover, as maybe is already the case, that ravens are really, really intelligent, or parrots are really, really intelligent, and they have self-consciousness, and they have the ability to think creatively about the future or what have you, maybe we will think, oh, we need to revisit which particular types of animals belong, you know, in what types of groupings. This is the sort of thing that over the course of my lifetime, we've learned more and more about dolphins and elephants. And you think, yeah, maybe they're in a group not quite as high as people, but at least the next group down. Or here's a kind of science fiction experiment, science fiction philosophy thought experiment. Imagine that scientists invent some super duper vitamin, cognitive improvement vitamin, and if you give it to a dog, it changes the molecular chemistry of the dog in such a way that they develop the intelligence and cognitive capacities and emotional depth that an ordinary human being has. Well, at that point, I want to say it doesn't matter that dogs are in tier three or in tier four ordinarily. This dog, we have reason to believe, is a person, is self-conscious, rational, what have you. You know, when we start translating that dog's poetry, that's the sign that it's time to treat this dog as one of the exceptions. And so practical realism recognizes that we're going to have coarse-grained categories of a kind of necessity. But that doesn't mean that there won't be individual cases where we have reason to upgrade or maybe even in some cases downgrade somebody's vocation. And when all of this is said and done, it's going to be an explanation, I think, about why it's legitimate to perform, well, certain types of medical experiments on animals that it wouldn't be permissible to perform on people. And some of those medical experiments that will be permissible to perform perhaps on fish, but not on dogs. I don't have the details of this theory worked out. One of the reasons the title of the book is, the title's a bit of a deliberate pun, How to Account Animals More or Less. Part of the meaning of that title is some animals count more and some animals count less. But part of the meaning of the title is I don't have the worked out theory. I'm only gesturing in the direction more or less of what we need. And I leave it to others to work this kind of hierarchical theory out in greater detail. But once we have that theory, it should have practical implications. Just to mention another point, because it's so important to me, I said that the hierarchical view was something like the common sense view. But I say that with misgivings, because somebody says, well, look, the common sense says it's okay to eat animals. I don't really think it's okay to eat animals. I think even when the proper hierarchical view is developed, it will still turn out that even though human interests count more, the minor benefit you get, the slight extra pleasure you might get by eating a hamburger over eating a veggie burger, and even though animal suffering counts less than human suffering, the animal suffering still counts, and it counts enough to outweigh the minimal extra pleasure you're going to get. I think one of the reasons it's important to develop the hierarchical view fully and totally see this is the way an adequate moral theory is going to look is because we will never, this may be cynical on my part, but or pessimistic, but I think we will never reach the stage in society where we start treating animals with the respect that they are owed. The way we treat animals is a moral horror, and I look forward to the day when we recognize that and reshape our lives. I worry that we will never start treating animals with the respect that they deserve, the reflection of their moral standing and moral status, until such time as we recognize that, yes, they count, but they don't count with the same kind of status that people have. If the only philosophical positions on the table are they don't count at all, or they count the same as you and me, too many people are going to conclude, oh, I guess on reflection, they don't count at all. I think the way to make moral progress here in our treatment of animals is to see the necessity and the plausibility of a hierarchical theory.
Professor Shelley Kagan, thank you very, very much for your time. I really enjoyed listening to it, and I'm absolutely sure that you have triggered a lot of questions. People will be listening to this podcast. And as I mentioned, it's really not in black and white, and you've rightly pointed out there are still a lot of issues hanging, and we just kind of scratched the surface.
Thank you very much for having me. This is such an important topic, our treatment of animals, it really is. I'm pleased, delighted that it's gotten so much more attention over the last 40, 50 years. My last words to anybody listening to this is become a vegetarian. Whatever your theory is, you really need to become a vegetarian. Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure chatting with you.